guard force. No one was replying, but there was definitely still a firefight raging on the second floor. Leo made it to the two expeditions in the drive. Then he spun around and lifted his small machine pistol high. He began scanning the second floor veranda for threats while still calling on his walkie-talkie. Gianna, Mohammed, and Ethan ran to him. Ethan said, "The expeditions. Do you have keys? Get in the black one." In the dark, both SUVs looked black, but once Ethan got closer, he realized one was dark green. He climbed into the back seat of the black expedition, and Gianna moved in next to him. Mohammed took the front passenger seat, and Leo got behind the wheel and started the truck. They lurched off down the muddy driveway, heading away from the inlet and into the trees. "Where are we going?" Ethan asked, looking over his shoulder to make sure no one was following. Leo's voice was weak.
"We can go to the docks on the east side, where we have boats. The Panamanian police boats will support us once on the water."
He coughed.
"Please, sit quietly."
This sounded like as good a plan as any to Ethan, and he found himself astonished to have made it away from the Americans. His hands shook violently. Gianna noticed this. She must have been going through her own panic at present, but she hugged him to comfort him nonetheless. Four naval Spetsnaz commandos burst out the French doors to the pool area and ran toward the remaining Ford expedition in the driveway. They had been fighting the last of the resistance upstairs when one of their number saw the taillights of an SUV at the far edge of the lawn, racing into the jungle, and the lieutenant ordered the members of his team still in the fight to take off in pursuit. Two Russians lay dead. One man had been killed on the back patio as he tried to pick a window lock for a stealthy entrance. A passing guard saw the movement and opened fire, and this caught the rest of the team still outside the house in the open. They'd fought their way inside, killed several Venezuelans in the process, but their attempts to take the American had been delayed and, at least temporarily, thwarted. A second Russian commando was felled in the archway to the gallery. The Venezuelans had put up a surprising defense, and now, as the four men raced to the remaining vehicle parked in the driveway, the lieutenant feared this operation was falling apart around him.
He'd wanted helicopters for this job.
He'd pressed for them right up until the minute he and his team climbed aboard the Cessna caravan with their parachutes. But the FSB was running the op, and they demanded Ross be taken to a yacht moored on the eastern edge of the island. Russian helos would be too overt, they had said. Any pictures or sightings of the birds would prove they weren't American, and the entire mission was to be constructed as a deniable operation. The lieutenant suggested using Nicaraguan helicopters, but the FSB had patiently explained this would do nothing to convince the world America had invaded Panama again, this time to recover a loose-lipped employee. Then the FSB impatiently told the commando leader to stop worrying about their end of the mission and to start worrying about his own end of the mission. The lieutenant dove into the front passenger seat of the expedition, and one of his men opened the driver's side door and leapt behind the wheel. They had already hot-wired the vehicle to use in their getaway. It was the lieutenant's one piece of good fortune that Ross and his entourage had run off in the other Ford, leaving the one prepped by Spetsnaz behind. The expedition kicked mud and rock and water into the air and shot down the drive in pursuit of the American and his confederates. Dominic Caruso raced around the front of the house onto the driveway, his pistol arcing left and right and up and down as he ran. In the distance, he saw a Ford expedition moving into the trees, and he raised his weapon to fire at it, but from behind he heard a shout, "Alto! Stop!" Dom froze, raised his hands, and dropped the pistol into the mud. Turning around slowly, he saw a Venezuelan guard with a G3 rifle on his shoulder walking across the patio near the pool, approaching rapidly. He shouted at Dom. No doubt they were commands of some sort, but Dom couldn't understand. The man was alone, a little more amped up than Caruso would have liked, considering he had a finger pressed against the trigger of his rifle and the muzzle pointed directly at his target's head. The gun flicked to the left. Dom assumed that meant he was supposed to head back through the French doors. He kept his hands high, then turned to walk back to the house, complying with the gestures of the guard, if not his exact wishes. The guard started following him, his rifle still pointed at Dom's back. Dom took a couple steps toward the house, and then slowed suddenly, but did not stop. He hoped the man would keep walking and actually touch him in the back with the rifle. He had no such luck, but the Venezuelan did say something, and Dom used the sound of the man's voice to picture the location of both the man and his gun. Dom spun, his right arm coming up, and he knocked the G3 sideways as a flash and the cacophonous report of a gunshot echoed across the lawn. He launched forward at the man, struck him in the chin, and the Venezuelan tumbled onto the driveway, rolling backward 360 degrees. Dom leapt for the rifle, but as he did, he realized his opponent was lying directly on top of the Beretta pistol in the mud. Dom lifted the G3 as quickly as possible and pointed it at the Venezuelan, who had just climbed to his knees and wrapped his hands around the Beretta. Dom aimed at the kneeling man's chest and pulled the trigger. The G3 went click in Dom's hand. The Venezuelan's eyes widened, and he quickly lifted the pistol to aim at the American's face. At a distance of less than 15 feet, he couldn't miss. Dom shut his eyes as the boom of a gunshot echoed off the colonial mansion behind him. 38. Dom opened his eyes when he heard the thud of a man falling onto his back on the gravel driveway. The Venezuelan was dead, the Beretta dangling from the trigger finger of his slack right hand. Dom spun around and looked out at the lawn near the water behind him. Adara Sherman stood with her M16 held high up to her sightline. Her black knit cap hid her blonde hair, and she wore a black zip-up raincoat, but her Virginia sweatpants gave her away. She lowered the gun and approached while Dom felt his knees weaken. It was just now setting in how close he'd come to having his ticket punched by some government gunman in Central America. Dom fought the urge to fall over, then dropped the empty G3 on the ground and turned to pick the Beretta out of the dead man's hand. As he did so, Adara Sherman shined a flashlight on him. "You're hit!" Dom looked quickly down at his body, feeling over his chest and arms. "Where?" "Your back!" Dom reached behind and rubbed his free hand on his shirt. He breathed out a long sigh. "A bird shit on me. That looks like blood. I think he was eating berries or something." "Oh, okay." Dom had the pistol now, and he shoved it into his pants. Adara scanned her rifle around the front of the house, looking for any more targets. There was no sound, as if everyone inside was dead. She said, "The boat is only a couple hundred yards east. I tied up next to a little beach. There's a footpath through the trees. Let's go." "I've got to go forward, not back." Adara kept scanning. "Really?" "The Russians took off in pursuit of Ross. I can't let them get the scrape and the password." "Okay," she said. "This is your op. Lead the way." "We need a vehicle. Over by the kennels there's a truck with a dead guy behind the wheel. It's running." "Good. You grab that and bring it back here. I'm going in the house to get a weapon." Adara took off around the front of the house. Ethan Ross kept checking out the back window of the expedition, but even though dawn had lightened the sky a little, he could see nothing under the thick jungle canopy. The road, while muddy and narrow, was in surprisingly good repair, and as they wound up a series of hills, the expedition's V8 engine roared with power, giving the three passengers confidence that the attack would soon be far behind them. Mohammed spoke on his phone. He kept the words hushed, although Ethan doubted anyone in the truck spoke Arabic. Ethan closed his eyes for a moment, trying his best to force himself to pick out some of the words. He was by no means fluent in the language, but had spent some time in the Middle East and learned some words and phrases. He was getting nowhere with Mohammed's quick, soft conversation. Suddenly, Mohammed began shouting. Ethan thought he was yelling into the phone, but almost immediately he saw that the young Lebanese man was screaming at Leo. Ethan leaned forward, and he understood the reason for Mohammed's agitation. Leo's eyes were closed, his head hung down, and his hands had dropped from the steering wheel into his lap. He was breathing in short wheezes, and he appeared to be unconscious. "Fuck!" Ethan shouted. "Get the wheel!" Mohammed dropped his cell phone and grabbed the steering wheel, but he was unable to get his foot on the brake across the center console of the vehicle. He looked ahead, steered with his left hand, and passed his G3 rifle to Ethan. "Take the gun! Push on the brake! Hurry!" Ethan did as Mohammed instructed. He pushed over half his body through the space between the front seat and jammed the barrel of the rifle between Leo's legs, and after a few misses, he found the foot pedal and pressed down. The expedition skidded to a lurching stop in the middle of the dirt road, just before a sharp turn to the right. Mohammed was able to put the vehicle into park. Then he leapt out, moved around to the other side, and opened the door. He yanked the Venezuelan intelligence officer out and let him fall in the mud. Leo groaned as he hit the ground, but did not move. Mohammed climbed behind the wheel. Both Gianna and Ethan knew the man was still alive, but neither said anything to Mohammed about leaving him bleeding to death on a jungle road. They were both more concerned about their own predicament. Ethan still held the rifle in his hands, and he climbed into the front passenger seat. Mohammed retrieved his phone and started talking. Again, softly, and in Arabic. Ethan shouted at him, "We can't stay here. Where are we going? We don't even know where Leo was taking us. The Americans might be just behind us." Mohammed looked to Ethan. "See if there is a map in the glove box." Ethan found a weathered map of the entire archipelago in the glove compartment, and hand-drawn lines over the island of Bastimentos indicated the road system. Mohammed took it from Ethan's hand and began looking it over carefully. "Hurry up!" Ethan shouted, and he looked back over his shoulder, certain the Americans were closing fast. A faint hint of sunrise in the east glowed as Dom climbed into the driver's side of a large and very old flatbed farm truck. Adara moved over to the passenger side, and she rested her M16 muzzle down between her legs. Dom ground the old gears as he got the vehicle moving, but it became immediately obvious the truck was built to haul big items around the island, not to chase down other vehicles. Adara registered his disapproval. "The Maserati dealership was closed. This was the best I could do." "The Russians are in a four-wheel drive Ford SUV. They are going to catch up to Ross." Adara reached into her jacket. "I brought the Eagle View printout of the island. I'll see if we can figure out where they're going and find a shortcut." Dom had turned pessimistic about their prospect for stopping the Russians from capturing Ross. His plan to grab the American trader himself was only a distant fantasy now. A shortcut? This thing won't float or fly, so there's not going to be a shortcut. "You may be right. But the good news is this road continues on for the next 5 miles. Then it keeps going to the west, but there's a turnoff that leads to the south. We just have to be close enough to them to see which direction they're going. They can't be more than a mile and a half ahead. We won't catch them before the turn. We'll have to guess which way they went." Adara looked closer at the satellite picture. "Hang on a second. There's a levee up ahead. It should be dry and flat and solid enough for this truck. It connects to the road on the other side of some twists and turns. If we take it and don't get stuck, we'll make up some time." Dom thought it over. "We're desperate. I'll give it a shot. Lead me to it." Mohammed folded the map and stuck it under his leg. Then he put the expedition in gear and started driving with the phone to his ear. The tires had just begun rolling when the headlight beams from a vehicle on the road behind filled up the cab. "The Americans!" Gianna shouted. Mohammed floored the truck, spinning the tires, but he picked up speed quickly. The vehicle behind couldn't be more than 200 yards back, and it was closing fast. Dom was astonished that they'd both found the levee in the dark and negotiated its distance without crashing. Twice Dom almost rolled the truck off the side and into the jungle when his wheels got too near the edge and the wet earth began to give way. Now they were back on the main road, and Dom flipped off the headlights as he made the turn. 100 yards ahead or so, they caught occasional glimpses of brake lights. Dom said, "That's gotta be the Russians. No way we got between the two SUVs." Adara looked back, but saw nothing. The light was getting better by the minute now, but under all the vegetation it was still too early in the morning to know for certain whether or not a dark-colored truck could be running without headlights behind them. After a minute like this, however, they came up a hill and out of the trees. Adara leaned her head all the way out of the expedition to scan the road. A quarter mile of it was visible for a split second before they made a turn. "Nobody. Those are the Russians in front of us. I don't know how far ahead Ross is, but he can't be too far." Just then the expedition made a hard right turn and took off to the south. Adara said, "If they knew to make that turn, they must have Ross in sight ahead." Caruso banged his hand on the steering wheel. "The Russians will catch him. And they have some sort of extraction plan on this island. A helo or a boat. We're gonna lose him." "I can try to shoot out the Russians' tires," Adara said. Dom glanced at her for an instant. "Can you make that shot in this light, at this distance, in this moving vehicle?"
"Probably not. Can you?"
"Nope." Another sigh. "Any more shortcut levees on that map?"
"Nothing.
The road straightens out here to the south for a while before going crazy again in the hills, about 1 mile ahead." Dom flattened the gas pedal to the floor, taking advantage of the straight road and the gentle downward slope. As a result, he had the Russians no more than 80 yards ahead now. There was no indication they knew they were being pursued. Dom presumed they were completely focused on their own pursuit.
"You're catching them," Adara said.
"Just on this stretch. We won't catch them before the turns come, and their vehicle is faster than ours."
"Not on the turns."
Dom looked at her quickly. Then his eyes went back to the road.
"What do you mean? They can corner twice as fast as we can. Plus, I have to downshift."
"You don't have to downshift if we don't plan on turning." Dom looked at the speedometer. He was going 50, and this was the absolute top speed of the truck. "If you've got an idea, I need to hear it." Adara put her finger on the map.
"A half mile ahead is a hairpin to the right at the bottom of this hill. There is nowhere for them to turn off before we get there."
"So?"
"They'll have to slow down to nothing to make that turn. They'll have to. But we keep on going full tilt down the hill. We can catch up to them."
"But how do we stop?" As he asked the question, he thought he knew the answer.
"We stop when we slam into them. We just plow right into the passenger side on the turn and knock them off the road."
"Holy shit," Dom muttered. "What's the terrain like on the far side of the hairpin?"
"It's jungle. This whole island is jungle, Dom."
"I know that. I want to know if we're going to go tumbling down a hill if I miss the truck." She looked at the image.
"It's difficult to tell on the sat photo."
Dom sighed. "Try really hard, Sherman. Play like our lives depend on it." She gave it another glance.
"It's not a cliff or anything like that. It's just rainforest. Maybe descending away.
If I don't time it right, we're going to shoot off the road and into the jungle at more than 60 miles an hour."
"Then time it right."
Dom shrugged.
"Okay.
Let's do it." Sherman reached over and tightened Caruso's seatbelt. Then she did the same with her own. Dom said, "After we crash, we're going to have to get out and shoot those guys."
"I know."
Adara then asked, "How much ammo do you have?"
"I have an MP7 I got off a dead Russian. 30 rounds.
I've got a few rounds and a pistol. Adara clutched her M16. She'd fired only one round, so she knew she had 29 left. We might run out of ammo in the gunfight, but at least we don't have to worry about reloading. Dom chuckled through the tension as he fixed all his attention on the vehicle ahead. Lucky us. The four Russian naval Spetsnaz men readied their weapons in the rear expedition. They'd closed to within 30 yards of Ethan Ross and his protection detail, and the driver told his lieutenant he would be able to overtake them in the next series of turns. He watched the SUV in front of them fishtail through a hard, muddy turn to the right that hairpinned down a hill to the west, so the driver slowed his own vehicle down in plenty of time to make the turn. One of the two men in the back seat yelled out, "Vehicle behind us!" And then he and his mate in the back spun around and raised their weapons, pointing them at the rear window and the truck beyond it. The green expedition began its turn to the right, and the vehicle was fully in the curve, when a burst of rounds from the pair of HKs in the back seat blew out the glass. "He's not slowing down!" shouted one of the Spetsnaz men. "Watch out!" screamed the other, just as the big, dark truck slammed broadside into the expedition. The SUV crumpled and spun. The front end whipped all the way back around and hit the side of the truck, and it rolled backward into the dense jungle. The flatbed jolted hard to the left with the impact, the front tires left the road, and it ripped through the trees just feet away from the Russian's SUV. 39. Ethan had been trying to keep his eyes on the truck chasing them, but he'd turned away for a moment when suddenly the headlights shining on him turned to the right. Ethan looked back, and in the dim morning glow, he saw mud and leaves and other debris kicked up in the jungle at the turn, as if the tropical vegetation had swallowed the American's vehicle whole. "They crashed! The Americans just crashed making that turn!" Bertoli stared back in shock, with her hands to her mouth. Mohammed took a turn himself, this one to the left. He tried to look back over his shoulder, but he saw nothing. "Good. That is good," he said. Then he switched back to Arabic and continued talking in his mobile phone. The smell of radiator fluid mixed with the earthy scent of the jungle. Dominic felt a sticky wetness on his face from his hairline all the way down to his neck. There was next to no light here in the cab of the truck. They'd come to rest upright, somewhere off the road in the rainforest. The hood of the truck was smashed and up in the windshield, and there was broken glass all around. Before he checked on what he assumed was a gaping wound to his head, he looked to his right to see if Adara was okay. But he couldn't see her. A fat and lush ficus tree had crashed through the windshield, and now all Dom could see next to him were leaves and broken branches. He reached out through the greenery and felt for Adara. He grasped her left shoulder and was glad to feel movement. She was in the process of unbuckling her seatbelt. "You okay?" he asked. As he spoke, he reached to his face, and he was relieved to find the source of the dampness there. A large wet palm frond covered the entire left side of his head. He pulled it off, and then unsnapped his own belt. Adara didn't answer. Dom grabbed the small HK MP7 personal defense weapon he'd jammed between his seat and the door, and turned to find Sherman. In the low light and thick wreckage of foliage, he had a hard time pushing his way toward her, but before he could even call out to her again, she shouted at the top of her lungs. "Contact right!" Sherman opened fire with her M16 through the passenger side window. Dom didn't hesitate. He opened his door and climbed out, then stood on his seat. Looking over the roof, he scanned the impossibly thick jungle on Sherman's side of the truck. He didn't see anything at first, but then muzzle flashes erupted in the thick undergrowth 40 feet away. Dom snapped the fire selector switch to fully automatic, and he began spraying bursts at the sources of fire. Between bursts, he shouted, "Bail out! My side!" He'd fired more than half a magazine in 6 3-round bursts before he felt Adara move past his feet and then drop out of the truck and onto the jungle floor. He turned and leapt off behind her, and as he did so, he saw her yank her rifle off the ground and point it toward the rear of the flatbed truck. In the wasted space of torn trees, flattened undergrowth, and uprooted plants, Dom saw a man spin around the back of the truck with a weapon high at his shoulder. Adara Sherman shot the man before Dom got his gun up. Blood blasted from the man's skull and splattered on the greenery all around, and he dropped face down into the brush. Dom grabbed Sherman by the shoulder and pulled her with him, and they moved away from the vehicle, deeper into the jungle, in the opposite direction of any surviving Russians. As they retreated, they fired a few rounds in the general direction of the threats, covering their withdrawal. Within moments, they backed up into a rusty, corrugated shack. It looked like it must have been some sort of storage shed. Maybe a farm had been here before the rainforest reclaimed the area. Dom and Adara moved around to the back of the shed, doing their best to find cover from any Russians remaining in the jungle around them. They both took a knee, Dom covering one side of the shed and Adara the other. Back to back, Sherman said,
"You okay?"
"Yeah, you?"
"Good enough. There could still be a couple..."
Dom reached back and squeezed her arm, silencing her immediately. He heard movement in the jungle around his side of the shed, still several feet away, but approaching quickly. He unseated the magazine in the grip of his MP7 and checked. He had only 3 rounds remaining. He replaced it and whispered to Adara,
"Ammo?"
He heard her drop her mag, check it, and then click it back into place.
2.
Dom pulled the Beretta from his pants and handed it back to her. She took it without looking. He said, "Count to 10 and empty the Beretta into the trees."
"Roger."
Dom rose, moved to the edge of the shed, and peered around carefully. He saw nothing but thick jungle ahead, so he moved around the corner, then up to the southeastern corner. He stopped here, readied his weapon on his shoulder, and waited. Soon he heard Sherman open fire with the handgun. He hoped this would flush out anyone in the trees near the crashed vehicles, get them to return fire. With luck, he would see the muzzle flashes and engage them by surprise. But as he spun around the corner of the little shed, he was surprised to see a pair of men, themselves using the shed for concealment. As Sherman fired on the other side of the dilapidated building, one man lifted his weapon to fire through the rusty tin walls. The second man peered around the corner toward the source of fire, not 15 feet away. Dom knew Sherman was a sitting duck. She had no idea these guys were here on the opposite side of the shack. He shot the first man just as he fired through the tin. The Russian wore body armor, and he absorbed the hit and spun toward Caruso, just feet away. Dom shot him twice more, the third round taking him in the jaw and killing him instantly. But Dom knew he was out of ammunition. As the last remaining Russian spun his MP7 around to Caruso, he leapt back around the corner of the tin shack, landing hard on his back in the overgrowth. Dom screamed, "Sherman! Hit the deck!" The Russian opened fire on the shack, spraying copper-jacketed lead into it to kill the 2 threats around opposite corners. Dom felt bullets snapping just over his head, and from the sounds of cracking branches around him, he could tell the man was sweeping his fire back and forth, trying to gun down Adara as well. For an instant, Dom had no idea what to do, but then he remembered the diving knife. He reached to his right ankle, pulled the titanium blade from its sheath there, and when the Russian stopped firing to reload his automatic weapon, Dom leapt to his feet. All around him, leaves fell from the trees and bushes, all victims of the heavy gunfire the jungle had just endured. Dom raced around the corner of the tin wall, now pocked like Swiss cheese, and he caught the Russian just as he'd chambered his weapon with a fresh round from a fresh magazine. Dom dove for the man, who spun toward the movement, but Dom collided with him before he could get his gun up, and both men crashed into the brush. The Russian fought back for a short moment, but Dom drove the knife handle deep into the man's stomach below his body armor, and the fight stopped. When the last Russian lay dead under him, Dom shouted for Sherman between pants.
"Adara! Adara! You okay?"
He fought his way up to his knees, pushed off the tin shack to hurry around to check on his partner. "Coming around! Don't shoot!" Dom saw Adara rolling on the ground, her arms and legs flailing. He assumed she'd been hit, but at least she was moving. "Adara," he knelt down to her. "Lie still. Where are you hit?" She kept flailing. "I'm not hit. You told me to get down, so I dove for the deck. Landed on the damn anthill." She reached under her black parka. "Little bastard's got inside my jacket." A wave of relief washed over Caruso, and he couldn't help laughing. The Black Ford expedition drove off the dirt road and right down the middle of an empty sandy beach at the southern tip of Bastimentos Island. Before Ethan or Gianna could ask what he was doing, Mohammed skidded to a violent stop at the water's edge. He said, "Everyone out. Quickly, please." Ethan looked out to sea. There, in the calm waters just 50 yards from the shoreline, a blue-and-white, single-engine de Havilland Beaver float plane approached slowly, its propeller spinning just fast enough to give it some forward motion in the water. Mohammed said, "Please, we must hurry to the plane." "Whose plane is that?" Ethan asked. When no one answered, he looked to Bertoli, and quickly he recognized she didn't have a clue where the hell the young hacker Mohammed managed to score an airplane either. But he climbed out of the expedition and followed Mohammed into the water, and now he counted 4 men with the aircraft. One sat in the pilot's left seat, and another man, presumably the co-pilot, sat on his right. Another climbed out of the cabin and stood on the float closest to the beach, and another jumped out of the other side, into the knee-deep water, and he began wading behind the float plane, avoiding the propeller on his way to the shore. The 2 men outside the aircraft were tough-looking and olive-skinned, with short haircuts and khaki shirts and pants. Ethan looked to see if the men were carrying guns. At any other time, a gun would have uneased him, but right now he would have been happy to see that the people here to rescue him had some way to fight off the Americans, who still might be only minutes behind them. He saw no weapons on them, but wondered if they had something concealed. They certainly looked like some sort of security force. Despite a list of misgivings a mile long, Ross took off his backpack and held it over his head. Then he followed Bertoli and Mohammed and crashed through the water on the way to the plane. He took the hand of one of the olive-complexioned men, who pulled him up and ushered him into the back of the cramped cabin without a word. Within seconds, the Beaver's engine roared. The interior of the aircraft rattled and shook as if it could fall to pieces, but the machine picked up speed and lifted off into the cool dawn. Mohammed Mehdi Mobasheri placed a headset over his ears and brought the microphone to his mouth. The leader of the Quds Force men with him, Shiraz, did the same next to him, right behind the pilot's seat. Mohammed was careful to speak in Arabic, in case Ethan Ross could hear any of his words. He knew Ross didn't speak the language, even though the Middle East was his specialty at NSC. Mohammed said, "Good work." "Thank you. We will have a jet waiting for us in San Salvador. We can be in Tehran in less than 20 hours. Mohammed shook his head. "There is nowhere I would rather go, but we're not finished yet. We'll go to El Salvador, and then the woman will tell us where to go from there." Shiraz stared back in disbelief. "Why are you letting her make the decisions?" "We want the intelligence on the drive, and we can torture the American to give us his passwords. My first choice would be to throw her out of the plane now and make him decrypt the files. But Bertoli's organization is helpful to us. We will go back with her to Switzerland and spend the next few days working with her on Ross. We will persuade him to give us the information so we can categorize it or redact critical information so we can publish a portion."
"I don't know, boss," said Shiraz. "I like your first idea better. The woman complicates things."
Mohammed nodded.
"Agreed. They have the tendency to do that. If she becomes too much trouble,
Forcibly removing Ross from the protection of the ITP will be the easiest part of this entire operation. Shiraz nodded. I'll await that order. Adora Sherman and Dominic Caruso made their way back onto the dirt road a few minutes after engaging the Russians. They were 100 yards away from where the firefight had taken place. They'd seen no evidence any Russians were still alive, but they didn't know how many had been in the expedition in the first place, so they couldn't be certain. As they began walking south on the road, both of them stopped to watch a float plane fly overhead, ascending into the early morning. Dom had pulled an MP7 from one of the dead men, and now he pointed it at the aircraft, placing its holographic red dot sight on the single engine. But he did not fire. Instead, he just muttered, "If I shoot it down, it won't be Ross. It will be a group of nuns down here on a mission trip. But since I didn't shoot it down, I'd bet money we just watched Ethan Ross slip away." The plane disappeared to the north. Adara started walking again. She was still picking ants out of her clothing.
"Do you think those were Venezuelans?"
Dom said, "Don't know. At least it wasn't the Russians."
"Might have been another group," said Adara.
"This shit is getting complicated. We kept Ross out of the hands of the Russians, but for all we know, whoever has him now is even worse."
"What do we do now?"
Dom sighed. "We go home." 40. Special Agent Darren Albright returned empty-handed from Panama late in the afternoon. His FBI jet landed at Reagan National, and the rest of his team, mainly hostage rescue team members, left for their homes around the D.C. area, mostly in Maryland and Virginia. Albright, however, climbed in his FBI-issued Yukon and drove into the district. He parked in a loading zone in front of a residential building near Logan Circle, tossed his FBI parking decal on the dashboard, and took the elevator to a condo on the 5th floor. Dominic Caruso opened the door to his place. If he was surprised to see Albright, he didn't show it. "You made it back fast. Come on in." Albright followed Caruso to his messy living room, then sat in the leather chair while Caruso plopped down on the sofa. Albright said, "I've been trying to get in touch with you."
"Sorry about that. Lost my sat phone this morning."
"You made it back quickly yourself."
"Just got home. First plane out of Bocas. First plane out of Panama City."
"You hurt?" "About 150 bug bites. Does that count?" "Considering what went down, not really." Albright added, "I saw you tried to call me before the Russians hit the safe house."
Dom nodded. "They dropped out of the damn sky."
"We heard. Panamanian police interviewed witnesses. Sounds like there was quite a show this morning. I'd love for you to tell me what you saw."
"When did you guys get there?"
"We were 90 minutes out when the shooting started. We arrived on scene after the Panamanian police. Didn't go in. We found out through embassy channels that there were no Americans present. We had concerns Ross might have left his stolen documents behind, but he didn't." Albright cocked his head. "You know this how."
"He had the scrape with him right before he left the house."
Albright raised an eyebrow, so Dom answered the next question before it was posed.
"He told me."
"Wait. You talked to Ross?"
"Briefly. I almost had him in hand."
"But?"
"Shit happens. He got away."
"No idea where he went?"
"Didn't see the tail number of the float plane. Don't imagine they filed a flight plan."
"Did you learn anything from the Panamanians about the aircraft?"
Albright just shook his head.
To Dom, the FBI special agent looked like a man at the end of his rope. He'd probably not slept 3 hours in a row since getting the case more than a week earlier, and now it looked like he'd hit a dead end.
"Nothing."
"So what happens next?"
"I keep hunting for him.
I've got a criminal complaint with his name on it. Violation of U.S. Code Title 18, Section 798. Theft of government property, unauthorized communication of national defense information, and willful communication of classified communications intelligence to an unauthorized person. He's wanted for questioning in 4 murders as well. He'd go on the 10 most wanted list, but I am sure CIA will lobby to keep this somewhat quiet. The Bureau will push back because of Nolan and Beale, our 2 SSG guys. Interdepartmental bullshit aside, any way you slice it, Ethan Ross is now America's most wanted. He added, I guess your uncle the president could just drone kill the son of a bitch, but we'd still have to find him first. Dom dreaded the answer he might get, but he asked the next question anyway. Why don't you guys just offer him immunity for the breach if he returns the scrape and comes back to deal with the murder investigation? I imagine the offer will be made if we can prove he hasn't leaked the scrape to a foreign power. Obviously he did leak it. You told me Venezuela is arresting agents en masse. That's small ball considering what's in his possession. Dom asked, do you really think they might extend immunity to him for giving it all back? I'm a law and order guy, as you've mentioned before. I'd like to try him, convict him, and give him the needle for killing Nolan and Beale. Still, decisions like that are far above my pay grade. The CIA might press for immunity, depending on what he has. Caruso told himself that if Ross received immunity by the Justice Department, he'd find him and kill him himself. It was easy to say, but harder to do. The guy could be anywhere in the world right now. Minutes after Albright left, Jerry Hendley called. Dom had been expecting a call because he knew Sherman would call Hendley as soon as she headed back to her place. Dom wasn't bothered by this. Adara had kicked ass in Panama, and if his only price for all her help was that she was keeping their employer apprised of his mental state, then so be it. And to Hendley's credit, he did nothing to hide the fact that Sherman served as his surrogate eyes and ears. I spoke with Adara. She gave me a pretty detailed after-action report on your exploits in Panama. I figured she would. I guess she told you I let Ross slip away. She didn't characterize it like that. She says the deck was stacked against you and you did your best. I am sick and tired of doing my best. It doesn't matter. Ross is still out there somewhere. I've been reaching out to my contacts in the intelligence community to find out just what level of threat his information poses. Dom asked, how big is this? Has the CIA given you specifics yet? Hendley said, it's potentially ruinous. Over 150 gigs worth of docs, most top secret. Local agent information vacuumed from case officer reports. Front companies listed by name. Affiliate and liaison intelligence services. Names of agents? No, but plenty in there to ID them. If these files make it into the wrong hands, the entire U.S. intelligence community will take a devastating hit. Jerry continued, we can't say this is the biggest intelligence leak in U.S. history. That was a couple years back when the Chinese took 40 terabytes of DOD files. But this is the leak that will get more people killed in the intelligence community than anything we've faced, ever. Think about it. Virtually every agent on CIA's payroll. That doesn't just expose thousands of foreigners around the world. Anyone who has access to this intel can dig into those foreign agents and find out who they met with, and that will lead them to larger networks. It will also lead them back to their American case officers. Jerry exhaled into the phone. If Ross's leak makes it into the hands of a foreign power, the ramifications will reverberate for decades. The agency will have to bring in a new generation of case officers and recruit a new generation of foreign assets. That has never happened. The United States will suffer greatly in these down years.
It will be devastating.
Caruso rubbed his eyes.
We have to plug the leak. There is no other alternative.
The FBI, state, and the U.S. intelligence community are doing everything they can. Your uncle has made it the priority it needs to be to get attention.
Dom said, I'm not doing everything I can.
I need to get back out there, Jerry. You want to continue your involvement in this matter, don't you?
Damn right I do. I want to see this all the way to the end.
There's probably some speech I could give you about not making this personal.
Dom half rolled his eyes.
Yeah. If it'll make you feel better, I'll sit here while you give me that speech.
No need.
But I do need to let you know the rest of the campus is operational again.
This surprised Caruso. They're working on getting the data back?
Negative. It's another situation entirely. They're on their way to Asia right now.
Tell me about it.
No. You are deployed on your own operation. When you are ready to rejoin your team, I'll read you into their op.
But, Dominic, at this point you don't have a need to know. You are running solo. Stay that way until you're ready to integrate back into the campus fully.
Dom grumbled out a yes, sir, and the call ended a moment later.
Dom was both angry and frustrated, but he had the presence of mind to realize he did retain some control. If he could somehow affect the outcome of the Ross investigation, he could move on and rejoin his unit. To that end, he went back to his laptop and opened up his IBM i2 analyst's notebook software. He began wading through the data findings of all the intel he recorded from Ethan Ross's home. He'd loaded it in his computer days earlier, but the data points hadn't led to any real pattern analysis conclusion. To find anything in the treasure trove, he knew he would need to add some more context. Otherwise, he would have to run down every lead, every name off every phone number, or every connection between all the disparate data points.
That wasn't a job for a man alone on his couch. That was a job for the FBI.
The only problem with this was the fact Dom knew Albright would throw him in jail if he somehow managed to produce hundreds of pieces of intel from Ross's house. The FBI would have access to the same information that Dom now had, so he didn't feel too bad about keeping it to himself. As he looked through the data, more than 8,000 items in all, he focused on the handwritten addresses and phone numbers. He began highlighting numbers, searching on a graph for any link analysis or trends with that number. He didn't have the ability to trace any phones other than simple internet searches, but this ruled out the vast majority of all numbers. Still, there were several phone numbers that had no known relation to any other bits of data. They weren't restaurants, NSC or White House employees, or known friends or relatives of Ethan Ross.
Dom wondered if answers were staring him in the face, but all this information was more overwhelming than it was elucidating. He decided to change his strategy. He pulled up the photographs of the three pill bottles he'd found in Ross's kitchen. He enlarged the images, then enlarged them again, and soon he was on the internet looking at pillid.com. He typed in the shape, color, and markings of each tablet, and within 5 minutes he had identified all three drugs. Clonazepam, glycopyrrolate, and sertraline. He wasn't familiar with any of the medications, but as soon as he started researching them, he realized these were the meds the polygraph examiner Finn had suspected Ross of taking. If Ethan did not have a prescription of his own for these meds himself, it was reasonable to conclude someone had given them to him, and not beyond the realm of possibilities that that person was aware of his need to defeat the FBI polygraph. Dom realized he needed to find the doctor who had prescribed all three meds somewhere in the 48 or so hours between Ross's learning he would be polygraphed and the actual exam. These weren't ironclad times, of course. Ethan could have had these pills for months or years. They could have been sitting around since his last routine poly. but Dom knew the 48-hour parameter was the most likely. Dom had no way to find the doctor on his own. He knew he could either contact Albright and quite possibly get tossed in jail for breaking and entering, or reach out to David at the Mossad. The Israeli had shown his organization had the ability to get answers. Dom didn't know how they were doing it, although he suspected they were getting help from key members of the U.S. intelligence community. He decided on David, although he didn't know if the Mossad man would be much help. The two men had not spoken since Dom went radio silent in Panama. David answered his phone after several rings, and his greeting told Dom that all would not be forgiven easily. "You have demonstrated to me that you do not contact me to provide me with help, so I can only assume you need something."
"Yeah. I'm sorry about yesterday."
"I thought we had an agreement about Panama." Facts on the ground changed quickly. "We know about the digital breach Mr. Ross made."
Dom assumed he would have heard about the scrape. He said, "I hope you understand that I wasn't in a position to discuss that with you at the time."
"That's fair. But you handled the situation poorly. I am disinclined to help you now."
Dom said, "I have a piece of evidence that might lead us to Ethan Ross."
David chuckled, but there was coldness to it.
"Us, Mr. Caruso?"
"Well, me. Look, I want to help U.S. intelligence get the files back. I'm not sure what you know about the scope of the breach, but I'm sure your organization can see that's in Israel's best interests as well."
"Go on."
"If I find Ross, I would love to kill him myself, but killing him won't get the data back. I'll bring in the FBI. I have no choice. I know you want vengeance. We both want vengeance. But vengeance can wait. We agree with your assessment. Getting the data back is paramount. How can we help you?"
Dom told David about the pills, and his theory they were prescribed between Monday and Wednesday of the previous week. David said he'd see what he could find. The return call came in only 35 minutes. Dom was astonished how fast it had been. He answered with, "You have got to be kidding." He could hear David smiling when he talked.
"Whoever obtained these medicines was very clever. They did not use the same doctor for all three."
"How can we know the meds are related to Ross if they didn't come from the same doctor?"
"The clonazepam and sertraline are very common anti-anxiety drugs, and they are often prescribed together. But in a 100-mile radius of Washington, D.C., only three doctors prescribed glycopyrrolate between Monday and Wednesday of last week. It's not a common medication."
"Okay. Give me the three names. I'll check them out."
"No need. Two of the doctors are dermatologists. It is a medicine for excessive sweating, so that is quite understandable. The third doctor, however, is a heart surgeon in downtown D.C.
"A heart surgeon? That sounds fishy."
"Indeed."
David gave Dom the man's name and number. Dom plugged the information into his analyst's notebook, but was frustrated to see no connections to any data points there.
"Nothing," he said. David replied, "I can email you his call logs for that time period."
Dom's eyebrows rose. "That might be helpful." Within minutes, Caruso's 8,000-point file on Ross had an additional 312 pieces of forensic evidence, all phone calls going to and from a cardiac surgeon in downtown D.C., both his office and his mobile phone. After loading it into analyst's notebook, Dom clicked on a visualization tool that would show him any interconnection between data in Ross's home and the surgeon. A graphic came up on his screen, and when he highlighted it, he saw an image of a post-it note, and on it a handwritten phone number that Ross had left sticking out of a magazine lying on a coffee table on the back porch.
David had been waiting on the other end of the line.
Anything?
One more number to trace.
Give it to me.
Dom read it out. There was a pause of less than a minute, and then a reply. That is the mobile phone belonging to Harlan R. Banfield of Washington, D.C. He is a reporter, used to work for the Post.
Bingo,
said Dom. A journalist had arranged for Ross to beat the FBI polygraph. Dom wondered what else the man had done. 41. Harlan Banfield stepped off the elevator into his parking garage, tired from a full, stressful day. He walked to his Volkswagen in the corner, and while doing so, he told himself he was getting too old to work so late in the evening. The garage was 4/5 empty. He figured he was the only person in the building putting in 12-hour days. He'd taken a few steps toward the elevator when he noticed the shape of a man standing in the darkness between two cars off his right. He thought of Ethan. This was just a few yards away from where the NSC whistleblower had appeared from the dark the week before, starting this entire traumatic episode for the 66-year-old journalist. But where Ethan had merely stepped into the light, this figure stormed forward out of the dark, charging at Banfield. The man grabbed Banfield by the coat and slammed him up against a cement support column, then yanked him around behind the column, hiding him from anyone else who might come out of the elevators. Banfield was too breathless to scream, but when he saw the gun, just a squat black pistol his attacker produced from inside his coat, he managed a small cry of alarm that emanated from the back of his throat. The man slammed Banfield again into the column, his head against the cold concrete by the attacker's forearm, and the gun disappeared from view. But Banfield knew where it went. He felt a hard metal object press against his crotch. The attacker was face to face with him now. He wore a mask, and Banfield could see nothing of the man's eyes, even though they were just inches away from his, because the light was so bad here in the corner of the underground lot.
"Who are you?"
Banfield tried to put power into his words, but they came out in a hollow vibrato. The masked man said, "I'm the guy who's gonna blow your fucking nuts off if you don't tell me what I want to know."
What do you want?"
"Ethan Ross. Start talking."
"Ethan Ross? Who's that?"
Banfield could see the man's mouth and realized he was grinning.
"That's how you're gonna play it?"
He jabbed the barrel of the gun harder against Banfield's manhood.
"This is how I'm going to play it. Wait, please. I'm not going to wait. I'm going to shoot you. I've got to prove to you I'm not fucking around, don't I?" "No, I know you're serious. I know who you work for. You're CIA.
"Not even close, asshole. Those pussies over at Langley have rules. I'm calling my own shots."
"Christ almighty. You were the one who killed Eve Pang. And the FBI men."
The masked man cocked his head.
"What are you talking about? Ross killed them." "Ross? No, that's ridiculous. Ross couldn't hurt a fly. It was you."
The man in the mask seemed confused for a moment, but he recovered. He jammed the gun in tighter between Banfield's legs. Banfield said,
I'll tell you whatever you want to know."
"Where is he?"
"I swear I have no idea."
"That sucks for you." The man pulled the hammer back on the pistol. The click echoed around the parking garage.
"Wait, I can find out."
"How?"
"I have a secure messaging service on my computer. I can check with someone."
"Jitsi? Chat Secure? Cryptocat?" Banfield nodded.
"Cryptocat."
"Who is your contact?" Banfield shut his eyes. He hesitated, but only for an instant.
"The head of the ITP."
"Give me a name."
"Bertoli. Gianna Bertoli."
"You are going to contact her right now. and you are going to find out what they did with Ross. Banfield nodded his head. Dominic Caruso took Banfield upstairs to his office at gunpoint. He had to remove his mask for this. He couldn't be sure they wouldn't pass others on the way, and walking through a downtown D.C. office building with a black neoprene balaclava would pretty much ensure the